Today on Straight Talk Africa, choosing the hero. My improbable journey and the rise of the first African female head of state, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. It's a hugely inspiring story by Washington insider River Levinson. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, September 27th. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to you, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter.
Today, we reflect on Choosing the Hero, the story about the rise of the first elected African female president.
And as you can imagine, we'll have a lot to cover coming up later in our STA inbox. We'll share your thoughts on our topic du jour through your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. That's ahead on Straight Talk Africa. Hope you'll stay with us.
River Levinson, an accomplished Washington insider, has written about her friend and hero, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. My colleague Paul Sisco has more.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf goes by many names, ranging from Madam President to, from her critics, warmonger. Forbes magazine ranks Liberia's Iron Lady as 83rd on its annual list of the most powerful women in the world. She's the only African on the list. Absent from the list is American K. Reba Levinson. More on her later.
True reconciliation means...
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is Africa's first woman president. She was one of two Liberians and three women awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is Africa's first democratically elected female president. Since her inauguration in 2006, she has contributed to securing peace in Liberia, to promoting economic and social development, and to strengthening the position of women.
Sirleaf's fellow Nobel laureate, Liberian peace activist Lema Bowie, has since criticized her president, first for significant nepotism within her administration. Several of Sirleaf's relatives hold high-ranking government and industry positions in Liberia. Bowie also says that while Sirleaf is improving Liberia's infrastructure, she's not doing enough to address the nation's poverty. Liberia remains one of the absolute poorest nations on the continent and in the world. Levinson recently wrote, Choosing the Hero, My Improbable Journey and the Rise of Africa's First Woman President. It chronicles her life and times with the Liberian president, their relationship and friendship. After two failed attempts and placing second in the 1997 Liberian presidential election, won by Charles Taylor, Sirleaf rebounded to win the 2005 election. President Sirleaf took office on January 16, 2006.
I want to officially welcome President Sirleaf to the Oval Office.
Africa's first female president and Liberians have long shared good relations with the United States.
What we've seen is a continued determination on her part to have a full accounting of some of the tragedies that took place earlier, making sure that the country is refocused on development, being willing to tackle corruption, which obviously plagues not just Liberia, but countries throughout the continent of Africa. She has been committed to rule of law. She's made strides in reforming her judiciary.
We inherited a broken country, devastated by war, people displaced, infrastructure broken, institutions dysfunctional. But we said that we were going to make Liberia rise again.
Her critics accuse President Sirleaf of being too close to Washington.
I come today on behalf of the Liberian people to say that we've made a lot of progress in that commitment.
Levinson's newly released book chronicles her behind-the-scenes lobbying for the formerly exiled Sirleaf in Washington, D.C., as well as her difficult on-the-ground work in Liberia to help Sirleaf become head of state for the West African nation. Paul Sisco, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Now, joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. River Levinson, author, founder, president, and CEO of the consulting firm KRL International in Washington, D.C., and Eric Chinje, the chief executive officer of the African Media Initiative based in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Well, I have to say, River and Eric, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka.
Yeah, thank you. It's a privilege.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately, River. Your book, of course, is called Choosing the Hero. Mm-hmm. What inspired such a very interesting title?
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
You're most
so,
welcome.
Shaka, I had a story to tell. And the story is my story. Mm-hmm. 3 decades being a creature of Washington, traveling the world into some of its most inhospitable places in times of conflict, and meeting a lot of people who didn't live to fight another day, and also challenging myself and wondering what I was contributing to the world. And so part of the story, my journey. The other part is the story of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, as Paul Sisko said, but I don't talk about her triumphs, the Nobel laureate, the first democratically elected woman. I talk about who she was when I met her in 96, when she had no support and everything was lined up against her, and I talk about her humanity. So choosing the hero. Choosing the hero is about the intersection of my life with President Sirleaf and how we came together to do more than either one of us expected. And choosing the hero for me was the decision to believe in this remarkable woman and to follow her. So it's about the decision we make to make a difference.
First of all, very, very briefly, who is this great lady, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, really? Because each time you hear about her, they talk about a Harvard economist.
Right.
They don't tell you where she came from. This is a lady who actually got married at age 17.
Correct. Yeah. She. Well, that's what I wanted people to see in the book. She's this woman who got married at 17, who had 4 boys in succession, who was seized with a mission that I don't think she knew, but she knew she wanted to contribute to her country, who went to the U.S. Mm-hmm. for a degree, who came back, who fought for a position in government, who was jailed, who was nearly raped, who had to go into exile, who was in the most privileged position of all at the UN, sitting as head of the UNDP with a pension, looking at retirement, a nice life ahead of her. Mm-hmm. But she gave it all up, and she went back to her country to challenge the rule of warlords. And that's where I come in. And I watched her lose twice and then succeed the third time. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this story, and I've spoken to Eric a bit about it as well, because I wanted people to see the humanity of somebody who does something when no one else is watching, and no one else expects much.
Very interesting. She first came to the United States apparently back in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And where did she then go to school?
Michigan. Minnesota.
Actually, yeah. I think, you know, sometimes people say Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Okay.
Where she got an associate degree.
Sorry. Yes.
In accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I opened the book in Oslo, and it's absolutely freezing. And I talk about how if Ellen Johnson Sirleaf were waiting in line to enter the Nobel ceremony, that she would never make it because she hated the cold. And she hated the cold, and she learned that from her time in Madison.
Very interesting. What about you, Eric? I know that you have obviously won
several different hats, and through that you have been able to get very, very close to that great lady.
Yeah, well, it's one of those few privileges in life that you know, that makes the entire experience of life worthwhile. And this in great part thanks to Riva. Mm-hmm. And you're right, I did get, through this, my work with KRL and all, got to interact with the president and with Liberia, and of course, very constantly with Riva. And it's, it's been all very inspiring for me. And, it's allowed me to see up close not only what happens in countries like ours, like Liberia, but also how that relationship with the international community, and especially the United States, how that ultimately plays out in our countries, in Africa, in the developing countries. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm churning, all of this is going on in my head as I travel to Liberia, as I travel with River to South Sudan and all of this. And then this book comes out, and it not only captures that experience in a very unique way, but gives me the elements with which to fully appreciate them. That's why in my review of this book, I said every African leader should read it. Every African who's interested in the future of that continent and where this international community that we talk about so much, where all of that intersects with the future of the continent.
A must book, of course, a must read book. You also have been very uniquely, I think, blessed, frankly, in the sense that you probably met her as a practicing journalist, met her as a banker, met her as a UN executive, and met her as Her Excellency, Madam President.
Yes, sir. Yes, I recognize, that we're over a billion Africans, and, when you're amongst the 0.01% that mm-hmm. have exposure to these things, you've got to be grateful not only for your life, but for the things you've been able to achieve. But what's important is that we understand these opportunities and see how we can leverage them to improve on the quality of life on the continent. So my understanding of Africa now is very much built on all of these things. And I come back to the book again, we cannot quite understand the international play where Africa is at table without, there's some fundamental things as Africans we never seem to get. And I tell you, when I read this book, I kept nodding. I just like, wow, how could I, after all these years, all these things you talk about, all the exposure I've had, mm-hmm. how could I have missed this?
This is an incredibly, uniquely exposed lady.
Yeah.
Exposed leader.
Absolutely.
And to some degree, she was able to kind of like leverage that to the point that she actually, not only has she made history, but frankly, it's like a miracle because, frankly, I was one of those people who did not think that I could see a democratically elected female president in my lifetime.
Yes. No, we didn't think so. not with the macho culture of the continent. Things are changing. Social media is changing how we relate one to the other. Gender and the role of woman is becoming more and more obvious and evident to the rest of us. But it's taken these kinds of achievements, it's taken the kind of achievement we talk about in this book to remind us of what it takes to build a nation and build a continent. And, we can look at this book from so many levels, so many. I talked about the international community, talked about the role of women, talked about the politics and the geopolitics of the world, they're shaped by America and shaped by the Cold War. It's all in here. And my goodness, I again would push. I know you've read it, but those who haven't, they need to go through it. It's just an amazing product. And you know it, I know it, and those who don't, River.
What I was going to say was,
let's go for a break, and then we'll come to that. Now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on Twitter. Send us a tweet about the show and we might retweet it. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA, and we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa, become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
I wanted to present music and a side of American culture that is most important to me, that is a part of who I am. They're gonna get some incredible performances. That's one of the things I love, bringing these artists in so you can get to see them do what they do. It's soul music, and that's what music is. It's that which comes from the soul.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111, U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question, keep your comment brief, and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
You happen to be the first democratically elected female president in Africa. Has that come with any specific challenges that you have been able to face simply because you happen to be a female president?
A challenge to succeed. By being the first, I raised the expectations, you know, and the aspirations of women in Africa, of young African girls and boys and women all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge to succeed is strong, and I hope that I will meet that challenge and that they will see the period in which I serve as one that's made a big difference in the lives of Liberians.
You have accomplished a lot of things, President Sirleaf. Do you have any particular individual that you look at as being your hero, your role model, someone that gave you her shoulders or his shoulders to climb on in order for you to see a little bit further?
I guess my two heroes, have passed on. But certainly Julius Nyerere and Nelson Mandela, for so many reasons, are two people that motivate and inspire me and thousands of Africans and people all over the world.
That was, of course, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Welcome back, and today we are discussing the rise of the first elected African female president. River, you know there is no democracy in Studio 52. When the producer tells you to go for a break, you have to go, just like a disciplined soldier.
No, I noticed that. I just wanted to respond to what Eric said, because so many different people come back to me and say, this book brought this to me, or this is what it means. But what was important to me was just to tell the story and to not think about what I wanted people to understand or what I wanted people to take away, but just be true to the story. And the beauty of that is that's when you're true to your reader, because you're not trying to impose your view, but you want to draw your reader into the conversation. And I think that for me, that that's been the greatest gift of being able to share the book. I was in Monrovia, Shaka. I did a book launch in Monrovia, and Eric, I went on talk radio for 2 hours in Monrovia, which is a bit like dodging bullets. And it was remarkable. It was remarkable. A lot of young people called in, and I realized that people want to find the hero in themselves, and they want to believe in something, and they're not inherently cynical. And when I was in Liberia, it wasn't the behind-the-scenes Washington that connected with people. It was the fact that I'm not cynical, and that I believe that the Liberians will demand the best of their leaders, and that connected with people. I didn't want to leave. I would have stayed all day on talk radio. It surprised me.
You know, River, there are some people who have actually suggested that for an African country to democratically elect a female president in my lifetime is like the moral equivalent, in fact, of the fall of the Berlin Wall, or the end of apartheid, for that matter.
Yeah.
How do you react to that?
At the time, that's exactly how I felt. Because even in 2005, this is the third try, when we were convinced that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, at this time in Liberia's history, a woman, could bring the peace and the development and the connection with the disadvantaged people, that she could draw people in. But nobody believed it, Shaka.
What made you believe it? Was it because of your relationship with your grandmother, Oma?
Yeah. Do you know, I think what made me believe it is I met Ellen Johnson Sirleaf at a time in my life when I was cynical, and I believed in very few things. And I had just lost my maternal grandmother, my Oma, who had survived her exodus from Germany during the Holocaust. So there was this need in me to latch on to someone or something to, you know, to give of myself. And then I met this woman, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and I had no idea who she was. And in Choosing the Hero, it's a pretty funny scene. I'm taking in Teodoro Obiang of Equatorial.
Are we talking about 1996?
We're talking about 1996. And
New York.
In New York.
At the UN.
At the UN. You've read the book.
Of course I did.
And I'm taking Teodoro Obiang in to talk about an election that he just won by about 98%.
98%.
Yeah.
Only.
And I'm sitting there, and I'm on the side of the table with him, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is sitting there, and I speak Spanish, and I'm translating, and I have this epiphany that I'm on the wrong side of the table. I didn't want to be sitting here. I wanted to be with this woman who had nothing, who I knew she was standing up for what she believed, and she was going to go and return home. And I just didn't let it go. And one of the reasons, and I'll stop, I talk, one of the reasons why Choosing the Hero, I think, is rich in storytelling is because I'm a pack rat, and I saved everything of my encounter with Madam President, all of my notes, my emails, my original files, my 1997 articles, the press packet that we used when she was running in 97. And so I was able to recreate all that. And when I presented it to Madam President, she's like, oh my gosh, these are treasures. And I said that she couldn't have them until she opened a library.
Was this the time, River, when you worked for Paul John Manafort?
Yes. Paul John Manafort.
But then how could you possibly think like that? You are working for a guy, for example, who cares about the results without necessarily caring about the consequences.
That's Paul John Manafort. As we all know, he was the chairman of Trump's campaign before, I guess, about 2-3 weeks ago.
He had to resign.
He did. As Choosing the Hero reveals early, Paul sent me on crazy, pointless, soulless missions to Mogadishu and everywhere else. And he threw me in places where it was tough to survive. But you know what I'll say? I'll say that, you know, you can take from people what you want. And what I took from Paul was he's brilliant. And I took from him his ability to see through the clutter and to be able to understand the critical path. And even though all those places that he sent me were, as the book tells you, I was shot at and amoebic dysentery and all those crazy things, it made me stronger, you know? It made me stronger. And I think that without those 10 years of crazy, soulless work being deployed everywhere, maybe I wouldn't have had the capacity to do what I did for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Very interesting. Eric, a lot of people in this town, for example, when you talk about a lobbyist, you are obviously talking about K Street. People simply think in terms of the bottom line, making big money.
Yeah.
so as, of course, to paint positive images of sometimes not so very much deserving type of leaders, really. Mm. Someone might call them dictators.
Yeah.
You have a gentleman here by the name, of course, Theodore Obiang Nguema Mbasogo, mm-hmm. the president of Equatorial Guinea. He came to power about, since when? In fact, in 1979.
Yeah, 79.
When he killed his uncle, supposedly because his uncle was a dictator. And this man has been in power since 1979, probably the longest serving ruler or leader on this planet Earth. And you have a young lady here, River, who is doing her job, and somehow, by interacting with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf at the UNDP back in 1996, she just sees things differently.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I, you know, and go back to the book before I get to your question, one of the things this book did to me was forced me, and I don't know what your reaction was after you read it, but after I read it, and as I closed that last turn over the last page, I sat back for a moment and just kind of saw what I'd seen and what it forced me to do. I wasn't thinking about the book or what it said. I was thinking about my own life.
Right.
And I was beginning to see all the dots and the need to connect them. She had done an amazing job of connecting her own dots.
Yes.
And out of it came this amazing story. And I started wondering, how many of us, if we connected the dots, would find as amazing a story? That's what this book did to me. Now, to take us back to that, to the dictators of Africa, and again, every time I've spoken about the book, I've said, look, we all need to be instructed by what's in here, because it will allow us to see these naked kings for who they really are. It would allow us to do that. It would allow us to relate to leadership in Africa in a totally different way. And we need to do that. I think we need to get to a point where she got to, where she can see the real stuff and reject what is fake and unreal. You know, we need to get to that. And the reason we're still suffering on that continent today is because we see these fake fellas and we take them for what they are not. I wish we all could start seeing the Ellen Sirleaf Johnsons, Johnson Sirleafs, in our leaders, finding that core. And this is something this book can help a lot of us do.
For a continent, of course, that is incredibly wealth.
Yes.
And yet, people are incredibly poor.
Yeah, that's the, you know, that's the irony of our situation. But again, it is because we relate to the wrong things.
Very
and I think choosing the hero tells us who to relate to, how to relate to them, how to see the core as opposed to, you know, the flowery exterior, which may not mean much.
I think you said it, we have to be able to connect the dots.
Yeah.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. But first, here is Mariama Jaro. Take it away, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic and outstanding feedback we've received from our audience through social media. So please stay with us.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward. to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. And once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Mariama. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. As we've mentioned, President Sirleaf is the first elected female head of state in Africa and was jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for her contribution. She was recognized for her prominent nonviolent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peace-building work. Well, this leads us to our question of the week, which asks, would more women in governmental positions of power in Africa lead to more focus on nonviolent peace-building? Well, we'll start with a viewer in West Africa who answered our question in this letter of the week.
Omunua Okubo Igodalo from Nigeria writes, "Nonviolent peace building hardly has anything to do with the gender of politicians in government. Charismatic, transformational, and servant leaders are what we need in Africa if we are to avoid needless violence as we seek to develop the country. Africa's helmsmen must seek the opinion of the people and commit to a future that takes every citizen's legitimate interest as paramount. Therefore, it's the philosophy of governance and not the gender of political leaders that matters most."
Well, that was Omunua Okugbo Igodalo from Nigeria. Before we move on to other comments, just send us a tweet and let us know what you think about our topic. Just use the hashtag Women in Politics. And if you haven't yet, please do follow us on Twitter. Speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Emmanuel Kachele in Tanzania, who writes that African women in government are a symbol of hope, but they'll always be haunted by men's greedy character. Another tweet from Prince Habat Nukula from Uganda answers, yes, it will bring some change because of their vulnerability during conflict. They devise peaceful means to avert it. And one more tweet while we are at it, this time from Sydney G in South Africa, who says, more women in government are used by powerful puppet masters as pawns, posing as feminine gesture. Fewer is the trend. Very interesting. Now to a comment from a Facebook fan. It's Enoch in Zambia, who writes that peace is not gender-based. With or without women in politics, peace is attainable. It depends on the situation and how it pertains to humanity. Great points made here by our viewers. Shaka and guests, your take on these comments.
Interesting. River, your reaction.
So I think your guests are really articulate, and I think I agree with three of the four. But what I would say is that I believe that women can make a special contribution to peace building, and I think studies have shown that women have more tendency to be consensus builders, that they reach across party lines, that women also tend to focus on the vulnerable populations, the women and the girls. So I think women have a special quality in terms of post-conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think the Liberian president was the right person, whether it was a woman or man, at that time in 2005. I do think that we do need people of integrity. I think it's philosophy. I think it's charisma. But I think women make a special contribution in post-conflict peace building.
You may also, of course, add that conventional wisdom suggests that educating a man, you get an individual, but educating a woman, you get a community, society, a village.
I completely agree with
that. Very interesting. Mariama, do you have more social media reaction, please?
Yes, absolutely. We'll go to a post from Ayumuza Isaac in Uganda, who writes, Yes, more women in positions of power would lead to more focus on nonviolent peace building. Women are more organized than men, and they are more resilient. And one more comment while we're still at it from Facebook as well comes from Ngulube Jackson of Zambia, who says, I agree to some extent that a feminine perspective may change the approach to issues of peace and security in Africa. There are quite positive comments here. Once again, your take on this.
Very interesting. Your reaction to that, and more, Eric.
I take a very, shall I call it, natural approach to this. Look, two things. One, we've had men in leadership forever, and see where it's taken the continent. So, just trying something else.
We had two in Cameroon, my friend. Ahidjo and Korobia.
All right, I will avoid that bait. But, you know, is it Einstein who says, you know, you cannot...
If you keep repeating the same thing over and over again, expecting different results,
something's wrong upstairs. Yeah. Let us, again, if for no other reason than that, I think, you know, we ought to really in a more determined manner bring women into leadership in Africa. Secondly, there are more women than men on the continent. So what is so wrong with moving them up that ladder into leadership? So these are two, in my view, very powerful reasons for engaging women. And the debate is not about can women do more, can men do more. I don't think that's what it should be about.
But what should be done here? Because there's no debate, for example, when one is talking about his mother, his grandmother, his sister, or his wife, except other quote-unquote women. So what's the problem here?
Yeah, that's the point. I don't think there should be. But again, I think, you know, I've been to Liberia, and I know where this country came from. And I think, you know, President Sirleaf has demonstrated to the rest of us that given a chance, women can do a much better job. I mean, there are lots of Liberians who contest what I just said. But it's because they do not see the big picture. They have no clue where that country came from. They have no clue in what global context that country emerged.
They do not see the forest. They just see the trees.
Exactly. See the trees. And, well, you know, she's done a fantastic job, I have to say.
Thank you very much, Mariama, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Well, thank you, Shaka, and thank you to our guests. That will do it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. If you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com, or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords, Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Just sign up to VOA TV to Africa, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Just go to the VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Well, now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth one-on-one conversation with Namibian president. The wide-ranging discussion will include the president's vision for the future of the Southern African nation. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back, and today, of course, we are talking about the rise of the first elected African female president. Our distinguished guests are River Levinson, author, founder, president, and CEO of the consulting firm KRL International, and Eric Chinje, the CEO of the African Media Initiative based in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Well, again, River and Eric, I have to say frankly, how profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled I am to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
We're having a great time.
You're most welcome, of course. Go for it. Have a ball.
You know, I'd rather be here than anywhere else.
Especially, of course, when we're talking about serious stuff, really. Like
this company.
Yeah, but talk to us. Walk us through a bit of your experience, frankly, with this gentleman, Manafort, especially when he gave you your first assignment to go to Siad Barre's Somalia.
I will. So in Choosing the Hero, the book opens in Mogadishu, Somalia. It's 1989. And Siad Barre is in power for about another 60 days.
He's in power, but at that time, a lot of people suggested, in fact, that he was mayor of Mogadishu.
Yes, he was mayor of Mogadishu because as I was landing, one of the few people actually pursuing business in the country, the rebels were closing in on the city. And Paul Manafort got a phone call from a contact and said, Siad Barre, he's prepared to sign a contract. And he said, Reva, on a plane. So I got on a plane with John Donaldson, who is a actual 30-year friend of both myself and Eric Chinje, and we went for a crazy ride in Mogadishu. I mean, usually, Shaka, you know, when you go to these countries, something always goes wrong, particularly in the late 80s. So the plane doesn't show, I don't know, infestation of bugs, food poisoning, floods. The meetings don't happen. In Mogadishu, everything.
You somehow didn't like the bread.
I didn't like the bread. It was infested. But I brought Mogadishu into the beginning of the book, and I brought Paul Manafort into the beginning of the book because everything went wrong in that chapter. Not only what was happening, but the sense of purpose. It was a mission without a heart and a soul, and I was really ticked off. I sent, and every time I had a few minutes, I would just say, I wish Manafort was here so I could put him on the beach and push him into the sea. I would say that a few times, but I did that deliberately as a tactic of telling my own story because I wanted people to understand where I started and the missions I was. And then as you go through the book, which is, as you know, it's mostly a struggle. The book is not a celebration.
Right.
Even the end, I talk about Ebola, but I go through the struggle to show people how everything connects and then where you can, you know, where you can end up. The book also takes you to Angola.
Yes.
Where I was in Angola for the first failed election and caught in the first crossfire.
Correct, yeah.
So it,
interesting.
It takes you, I can't,
it takes
remember,
you to South Africa,
South
you know,
Africa.
Whatever. But let's go back to Mogadishu a little bit. Why did you, for example, refer to Siad Barre as Mighty Mouth? This was a general, Siad Barre, president
of
Somalia.
I have to go back in my mind, but that was his nickname. I mean, that was his nickname that was given by his people at the time.
Let me ask you another very simple question.
Yes, sir.
This is a man at that time, frankly, who was, by all accounts, in a sort of political intensive care unit. What could you, frankly, have done for him?
Nothing.
And he was going to pay you like a quarter of $1 billion? Okay.
So he was going to pay my company, not me. Remember, I'm like 25 years old on a mission assignment.
Yes.
But remember what was happening in the world, Shaka. We were in the midst of the fight against America and the Soviet Union.
The then Soviet Union.
And the then Soviet Union. It had not collapsed until 1992.
Correct.
The Berlin Wall hadn't fallen down yet. So you have these leaders who are very shrewd, and they're thinking, if I can just position myself with the Americans, I can hold on.
Very interesting.
They can help me fight these rebels.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought it was pointless. I talk about it. The chapter was excerpted like 100 times when Paul Manafort was chairman.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the dynamic. That was the time I worked for Manafort when we had a very different world.
When you complained, citing some human rights reports about the character and the person, frankly, of the Somali president as being a bad guy, that's what I read in the book. And your boss responds by, in fact, saying that we just have to make sure He's our own bad guy. Yep. Have a great trip. I mean, how did you feel? And when you went there and you're looking at human beings, really?
Yeah, I felt, you know, well, first I was personally traumatized because I was in a situation that was unstable the whole time. And then I was sent there and I saw the pointless nature of the mission and I didn't know whether to quit, whether to continue. And then it just became, Shaka, a point of getting the hell out of the country because the rebels were closing in. And then Siad Barre took the Somali airline, the Boeing 707.
To Libya.
To Libya to get the arms to fight from Gaddafi.
From brother leader.
Yeah. Yes. And left me there with broken Italian and great flirtation capabilities and got out of the country. And so I think that it wasn't until after, and I talk about that in the book, that I was able to reflect. But at that point, I honestly was in survival mode.
Now, when you look at all that has happened to you, all that you have walked through, and here we have a June 21st edition of Forbes magazine, which identifies your friend, your hero, President Sirleaf, as the 83rd most powerful woman in the world. Mm-hmm. How come River's name is not anywhere there?
Two reasons. One, before I wrote the book, Shaka, even though I thought so many people knew who I was and knew my story, but nobody knew who I was. I was behind the scenes. And so I think that's one of the reasons. But I have gotten such great privilege, such great meaning in my life from being able to make that contribution. It took me a decade to write the book, but it was only in the past few years as I was trying to put it together that I realized that my life had meaning because of my intersection with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Everything else was, like you said, Eric, it was a bit of the piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. But when I put it together, the art of writing a memoir, you discover yourself and your own story. And so I have great pride. And the other thing I will tell you is that, Madam President, I asked her permission to write the book, and she contributed nothing other than a few edits. And my favorite edit that she made was when I called somebody bald, she said, no, the head was closely shaven. But those are the type of edits that she made. But she had no idea that she meant that to me. You know, she just saw me as somebody who was fighting for her. She didn't realize that what she was giving me was more valuable than what I was giving her.
But how do you respond to some of her critics who have suggested that River is an incredibly powerful woman in the nation's capital, on Capitol Hill, to the extent, in fact, they have gone on to say that you may, in fact, have had something to do with her winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011, that you may, in fact, have arranged for it, River, because after all, she was facing an incredible election the following year.
So let me tell you a secret about lobbying and advocacy, is that most effective advocates in town are not the people who can go behind the scenes and make the contents and chats. It's really the power of the individual and the issue that you're carrying and your ability to convince. The truth is that my success is because I was commercializing the goodwill for this woman. You know, I love the accolades, I was supportive and behind the scenes, but all of these things Madam accomplished because what she did.
But you seem also to have very rare connections because, let's face it, your friend is the fourth African leader to have the honor of addressing the joint houses of Congress. Mm-hmm. In fact, she's the one immediately after Mandela, next after Mandela, correct?
That's correct. So after...
How did that happen? How does that happen? Does it happen to other people?
Well... That was kind of me. That was me, but also I'm going to take you to the history at the time and to the opportunity that I saw. This was somebody who had just made history, and nobody expected it. If you go through the book, you'll look at everybody in the U.S. government who told me she could not beat the charisma of an eighth grade soccer player. So it was unexpected. And so she rose, and everyone wanted to celebrate her. And I saw that. We had Nancy Pelosi at the time, who was the minority leader, but soon would make history as the Speaker of the House. We were in the middle of the Iraq conflict. Mm-hmm. There was no bipartisanship. And so we were able to see this spot, and we knew that Pelosi and then Speaker Hastert would see this opportunity to celebrate history and to celebrate it in a bipartisan way. And my favorite picture is Ellen giving the remarks, and Hastert and the president of the Senate, the Vice President Cheney, sitting behind her. One of my favorite pictures.
Very interesting. Yeah. I gather that we have to go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers, if you don't mind. Good evening, John Jackson from Tanzania. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Hello, John, are you there? Good evening, Okolo from Nigeria. Are you there? Well, I guess that we are experiencing some technical difficulties with the telephone lines from the mother continent.
Mm-hmm. Happens.
Yes, rainy of course.
Season. It happens.
Now, Eric, you believe her?
What, the technical difficulties?
She's being very modest. This is a very powerful individual in town.
You know, let me tell you this. You do know this, Shaka. I left the World Bank in 2012, and I had choice with regard to what I could do or should do.
You even worked with the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, a man who pays African leaders to do what they are supposed to do.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a that's a footnote in this story. But I had this choice, right? But I've always been driven by a need to leverage whatever it is I do, wherever it is I am, to hopefully make a difference, contribute mm-hmm. to making a difference mm-hmm. in Africa. So I leave, you know, these institutions, the World Bank, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, African Development Bank, and I'm thinking about the future, not totally certain what I want to do, but not under any pressure to do something. And I got a few calls mm-hmm. from quite a few people. And my friend, whom he mentioned, John Donaldson, who's in the book.
You got amoebic dysentery.
Yeah, you know, John says, Eric, you know, maybe you should join us with, KRL. Mm-hmm. And I read up on KRL, and I'd often had a few meetings here and there with Reva. But I realized, based on what I was hearing, because I was looking at the team, and there are three or four people sitting in this office, and I'm thinking, you know, what can they do for Africa? Mm-hmm. But when I saw the capacity of this team, this small team, to make a huge difference, when I saw that, you know, I mean, I've been in America for over 30 years, and I know that it's the dollar that drives things. Mm-hmm. But when I saw a dollar with a heart.
Exactly. A dollar with a heart. That's a very interesting expression.
I literally felt this is where I belong. I mean, it cannot just be.
You remind me of the late Tanzanian founding president, Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere, who used to talk about a need for a capitalism with a human face.
Exactly. Exactly. Hmm? Exactly.
Which is probably what in the West they call capitalism, of course, with corporate social responsibility.
Yeah. So, you know, this was that corporate body with that, you know, responsibility or that human face or the dollar of the heart, as we said. You know, and I was attracted to it. And for me, it's about feeling that the commitment is real. And when Reva goes into a story or goes into a situation in Africa, I think, you know, she goes with the heart, she goes with that real commitment. And it's amazing what real commitment and what the heart can do that physically we cannot. You know, it's amazing how the four or five people in KRL, I mean, when you hear about this organization, you think mm-hmm. it's one of the heavyweights of Washington, D.C. It's one of the heavyweights of K Street.
Interesting.
And that's what it is, four or five people moving, you know, what giants can't move.
So, you know, there's an African proverb that says that Alone, you can go faster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But together, we go farther.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Exactly. Hmm? Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yep.
But frankly, if we were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your New York heart and soul, or is it Connecticut?
Connecticut was where I grew up,
mm-hmm.
and I spent a lot of time in Manhattan. That was where my Oma was.
What made you believe in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on that day of 1996? Really, it can't just be that the other, you didn't quite, you know, you were not impressed by the other passage.
No, it wasn't that at all. First of all, it was the weight of taking Obiangyin to share information that was not credible. And then I sat with this woman and I looked at her and she captured me when she walked in the room. She commanded the room, this tiny woman. She's 5'6", she's a petite woman. And then she sat there and she looked at this man and she took it all in. And then she just stared him in the eye.
But
and
the president isn't tall either, is he?
No, he's not. But you're sitting, and he's the president. He takes that as his...
As a birthright.
Yeah, as a birthright. And she has not birthright. She just has her conviction. And she just dressed him down, but she dressed him down in a way that put all of the fundamental issues of human rights and democracy and respect and legacy, and I'm translating this thing, and I'm like thinking about what's happened, and I'm stumbling over my words, and the president is pretty annoyed, but I think I was captivated by her. And then when I found out, which I had hints of, that she was gonna return the next year, leave the UN, and go fight against Charles Taylor, who was the warlord controlling the country, I had to figure any way to get in front of her. Anyway, and I did. It was my old intern, and I think too she reminded me of my Oma and the spirit and the fight of my Oma. So I think that might have been part of it, but I didn't know that when I was going through it. It's only after I reflect.
Very briefly, what advice do you have for others who want to choose their own heroes?
Okay.
In 30 seconds.
In 30 seconds. Can I ask you a favor if it's 30? Can
sure.
Can I read the last paragraph of my book? I have time for that?
You try.
Okay, let me try. Let me try, because this is just the conclusion, and I think it's the best way because I talked a lot about it. So, working with Ellen has taught me to follow my heart and not fear being understood. I have come to see that certainty is a luxury and destiny a journey that reveals itself with time. It's easy to stray off course, to doubt and to lose faith, to see compromise as surrender, to feel judged, isolated, even abandoned. But there's always something to hold on to, the belief that things will get better. I've come to appreciate that we need people to guide us, those we admire, those we believe in, the heroes that we choose.
Wow. Do you think that Hillary Rodham Clinton has something to learn from your friend in Monrovia?
I do.
Good. Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, River Levinson, author, president, and CEO, consulting firm KRL International, and Eric Chinje, the CEO of the African Media Initiative based in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Thanks to affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Butte. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.